Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. My name is Amy Wheeler and I'm your host. And today I'm going to talk to a lovely clinical licensed healthcare practitioner from Australia who is also a yoga teacher and also someone who's training yoga teachers how to integrate yoga psychology for yoga teachers. And then she's also flipping the script and teaching licensed healthcare practitioners how to bring some yoga into their work. So she's looking at it from the two sides. And what she's not doing, which I find fascinating and wonderful, is she's not saying that she's a yoga therapist. And so we get into the nitty-gritty in this interview about scope of practice and what is being centered. Is the yoga being centered, or is the clinical mental health care licensure being centered? And to keep going back and forth and really looking at that question and why it matters. So I think it's a really sophisticated, interesting conversation. Dr. Lauren Tober is so fascinating and so lovely. I think you're going to really like this conversation, especially if you are interested in yoga psychology and kind of looking at how Western psychology and yoga psychology can come together. So let's go meet Lauren, and I'm really looking forward to this time together. Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour, Season 10, where we are going to go deeply into the eight limbs of yoga. Now let's go meet our guest. Welcome, Lauren. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Amy. I'm so glad we finally got to do this.
I know. Sometimes it's hard to get people from other parts of the world on the same time zone. And so, why don't you tell our listeners where you are right now in the world?
Sure. I live in Mullumbimby, which is a beautiful little town near Byron Bay, and many yogis around the world will know Byron Bay. It's a small town in Australia. It's the most easterly town in Australia. That's kind of our claim to fame here. And it is just a beautiful, beautiful little town. We're right on the beach. We have the hinterland, the subtropical rainforest, and we have a big yogic spiritual healing community here.
And it is summer there. Here I am in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm going to look up how cold it is here. And we'll probably not be able to compare because Fahrenheit and Celsius, but
Yeah, I'm not good at that conversion.
I know I can never, I'm like, whatever. But today we have a high of 12 degrees, and that's pretty darn cold. So
Wow,
it's pretty
that is
warm
very
for you.
beautiful. I don't even know what the temperature is today. Usually, this time of year, it's around between 25 and 30 degrees. It's on the cooler side today. I know down in Victoria at the moment, they're getting like insanely hot temperatures. It's about 45 degrees Celsius. Oh, you were talking in Fahrenheit
Yeah,
then, which
that's
is even,
right.
I was like, in Celsius, that's really cold. It's even
I
colder.
can't do the
Yeah, it's nice, temperate, warm here. You know what? 100 degrees Fahrenheit is around 40 degrees Celsius, I think. And
Okay.
so down in Victoria at the moment, it's around 45, so it's over 100. So it's been, yeah,
Warm.
global warming, climate change.
I'm just having this moment here, being kind of an introverted person. I've never really been good at small talk and just kind of building rapport. But I heard someone say this recently, and I want to share it, that when we come together and do small talk, it's kind of like a check-in, especially with our nervous systems. How do I feel with this person? And finding some common ground and some shared reality as the foundation of the conversation. So I just wanted to name that because I think it's important and it really shifted my idea about what some people would call small talk when I think of it as, oh, we're starting the foundation of our conversation. So just wanted to share that.
I totally agree. And I was thinking, wow, we're here talking about the weather. And it's true. Like it feels like I'm not a big fan of small talk either, but it can be kind of like you said, like an on-ramp into the conversation and a check-in and make sure, do I feel safe with this person? Do I want to continue this conversation? And it's feeling good. So let's
Me
continue.
too. Thanks. All right. Well, you and I have like overlapping interests. You've written this book about 18 months ago called Mental Health Aware Yoga, a guide for yoga teachers, and the publisher is Singing Dragon. And I really love this book. There's so much simplicity and elegance throughout, and there's so many nuanced things that I'm very excited to talk to you about. So,
Great.
what do you want to start with? Do you want to start with a little bit of your story? Do you want to just jump right into the content of Mental Health Aware? Just maybe like 3 to 5 minutes of who are you? What's the lens through which you're coming to this conversation from?
Nice. And thank you for the clarity with the time. It's interesting this morning before we started, I've been rewriting the training manual for mental health aware yoga. And just before we jumped on the call, I was writing about the importance of timing and letting students know how long what you're sharing is going to go for. And I think it helps us to stay regulated, to try something that might be a little bit outside of our comfort zone. And then we jump on here and you give me the timing cue. I love that. It was a beautiful illustration.
It promotes, again, safety and consistency and predictability. So that's why I do
Exactly what I was writing about. I love that illustration. Maybe I'll reference this podcast in the manual. So, a little bit about me. So, I am trained as a clinical psychologist and a yoga teacher, and I've been doing both for more than 20 years now. And initially, they were quite separate. I was, working as a psychologist over here and a yoga teacher over there. And the path only crossed a little bit in terms of mindfulness, but that's all. I wrote my doctoral thesis on mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. So, that was one of the ways that I started to weave them together. And then over the last 20 years, more and more of these worlds have been overlapping until, now at this point, they're pretty much inseparable. And so I run the Yoga Psychology Institute, where we offer training programs for yoga teachers about mental health, which is what the book Mental Health Aware Yoga is about. And we have a course the same. And then we also run training programs to support mental health professionals to integrate yoga into their work through the yoga psychology mentorship. And then we have other programs for, curious humans interested in this intersection between yoga and psychology.
Beautiful. So I think the thing that first jumped out at me when I read the book was sometimes when you have two fields kind of merging together, maybe sitting side by side, I'm not sure, like psychology and yoga. It occurs to me that sometimes we center one of the fields and then we show how the other one kind of inserts into the one that's being centered. And with your book, I couldn't really tell because it started off with a very Western framework with all these different conditions and the DSM. And I thought, oh, that makes sense because yoga teachers don't necessarily know that yet. So they're getting this like, hey, here's what Western psychology says. And then the second part of the book came in with the what you're calling yoga psychology. So I was just curious, were you thinking yoga was the center and the psychology was supporting, or vice versa, or they're equal?
That's a good question, and I love that you can't tell. That
Yeah, exactly. I was like,
delights me.
wait a minute, what's going on here?
So I started both of these at the same time, actually, when I think about it. And so they've both been threads or tracks in my life that have unfolded simultaneously. So maybe that's why it's difficult to tell. And I'm doing this interview series at the moment, which I'm going to be offering free in about May, where I interviewed a lot of mental health professionals who are also yoga teachers and asking them about how they bring them together. And it's so interesting that some people start as therapists, as mental health professionals, and bring yoga in, and some people come the other way. And I do think that it really does influence the way that they're integrated. So firstly, these came simultaneously for me at the same time. But having said that, when I introduce myself, I always, you might have noticed, start with the clinical psychologist title, which I guess wasn't really conscious, but leads me to think that that's probably where I lead. And that might simply be because maybe it's a little more accessible for people when working in the mental health space. But I do feel like that the balance is changing as I get older and much more interested in yoga than I am in Western psychology, that that balance is starting to shift. But I love that you couldn't tell. And that's a beautiful question. Thank you.
So the reason I ask is because Marlisa Sullivan and I are just writing a book together, and we had a 9-month period where we couldn't decide, are we centering the yoga, or are we centering the Western allopathic view? And we landed on centering the yoga and then inserting in the Western science to kind of support the yoga. But it was a real, it was a wrestling match for a while there to figure out, what are we doing here?
When I think about like mental health aware yoga, the book and the training is for yoga teachers. So yoga, I imagine yoga is more centered in that. However, it is written for Western teachers and, working with Western students, although it can be used much more broadly, but that's my experience. So that's what I'm sharing. But people are more and more psychologically minded. And so students will come with a diagnosis. They'll be seeing a psychologist or a psychiatrist. So I do think that it's really important we have this understanding of Western psychology in that. But then when I think about the other program that I've been running, the yoga psychology mentorship and these interviews, and I'm going to be writing a book on this topic as well, that centers more Western psychology because that is where many of the therapists are coming from, and then they're bringing yoga in. But what I'm really careful to do, and I think that this is so important, is that we do center yoga and we honor the lineages and teachers of yoga, and we don't kind of dumb it down and strip it so of its deep spiritual cultural context, because Western psychology has a long history of doing that, of appropriating things like, I mean, mindfulness is a really good example, right? Of stripping it of its spiritual, its cultural, the depth and embodied wisdom of the teachings, and just taking little practices and bringing it into schools or corporate settings. And that is something that I'm very aware of and I 100% want to avoid.
It's just reminding me of this kind of battle we've been having in our yoga therapy field with the International Association of Yoga Therapists. Who are we serving? Are we serving the yoga teachers and the yoga therapist, or are we serving the licensed healthcare practitioners? And so we had this huge falling out because the people who were the yoga therapists and yoga teachers who were really invested in these lineages and traditions and ancient teachings felt like they got sold out, and that the organization started focusing their attention on Western healthcare providers and licensed healthcare providers. So it really is a relevant topic of what's being centered and why and whom. Even though it sounds like a subtle difference, I think it's really important that we all know who we're talking to and who we are centering. And so I love that you have one book for yoga teachers, and you're going to write another book for maybe psychotherapists and mental health care providers.
The other kind of party to take into consideration, which in the psychology world they tend to give the most weight to, is the clients. So our registering body as psychologists and health professionals, their focus is on not on supporting the health professionals at all, which I actually find to be a huge disappointment and a hole in these organizations, but on the safety of the public.
Which is what licensing ultimately is about.
Which
Everyone
is,
wants,
yeah,
everyone
it's
loves
important. It's important, but
important.
it's not
And
everything.
yes, and there's this big argument, should like yoga therapy become licensed? Well, if we're not a threat to the public, there will be no licensing, whether we want it or not. We have to prove that yoga therapy is a threat to the public that needs to be licensed. And we just saw this with Ayurveda in the United States. They couldn't even get past the first door because the licensing body said, no, but you're not unsafe. Why do we need to license you? So it's very interesting.
That is unusual. I'm not quite sure what to make of
Safety
that.
of the public is their licensing goal,
So
Okay, so we
what do you
know.
need to do? Get more unsafe?
No, you don't. It's just that
It's a neutral.
Certain things don't need to be licensed, is the point. They're
I
saying
see. I see.
yoga is being done by so many people and
Yeah.
so many different schools and corporations and health clubs. You
Yeah.
don't need a license. You're not doing anything that could hurt people. So
Yes.
that's kind of something that people forget. They think that we're needing to get a license in order to make money so we can be a licensed
I
healthcare
see.
practitioner, you
I
know?
see. Yeah.
All right. So we've kind of outlined who you are speaking to. And I noticed in the book, and I love this about your book, that you right up front start talking about scope of practice right off the bat. You're talking to yoga teachers, you're talking even to maybe yoga therapists. Why don't you tell me what you're saying about that? I think it's more interesting to hear you say
And you're right. The book is written for yoga teachers, but it's also really suitable for yoga therapists as well. And we do have a lot of yoga therapists come and take the training to deepen their understanding of mental health. Scope of practice is so important for all of us, but I don't think it's often well defined for yoga teachers and maybe yoga therapists as well. So your scope of practice is what you're trained in. So your education, but it's also what you feel experienced and competent and confident in as well. And everybody's scope of practice is going to be different. And so one of the things we look at in the book, and I encourage my students to do in the training, is kind of take stock and say, well, what's my scope of practice? Now, for me personally, my scope of practice includes teaching yoga and teaching meditation, the whole thing of yoga that I've been trained in anyway. And it also includes mental health care and the psychological aspects of that. If someone comes to me, and I had this discussion with somebody yesterday, if someone comes to me and says, I've just been in surgery and I want a sequence to help me recover with my knee injury, for example, or, whatever it is, that is not within my scope of practice because I'm not a physiotherapist, I'm not a yoga therapist that specializes in that area. So my response will always be, I'd love to help you to find someone that could really support you with that because that's not within my area of expertise. But I know this great XYZ. And to be able to refer someone to somebody else, I think is such a gift that we can offer our students. And so maybe I can hand that over to you now, Amy. What's your scope of practice?
My PhD is in educational psychology, so it's kind of what they call these days a school psychologist. Although I never went the clinical route and did all that, I stayed an academic. But I still feel very well trained for my PhD in psychology. And so I think that's why I'm interested in yoga psychology and yoga for mental health. And so I too feel much more comfortable in that area. And I worked in a kinesiology department for 25 years at a university, and my master's, exercise physiology minor and things. So I understand the scope thing, but I think it's almost unique to each individual. And especially for yoga teachers, there's physical, there's mental, emotional. We're such a broad way that we are of service to people. So I don't know if, like, the organization, let's just say Yoga Alliance or whatever your equivalent is in Australia, how can they define the scope of practice for a yoga teacher? The IAYT has done it for yoga therapists, and I think pretty well done. But I think yoga teacher is, there's so many people doing like trauma-informed yoga, and trauma-informed yoga is okay, but yoga for trauma and treating trauma is not okay, right? So it gets very muddy in my mind, not for myself, but for our practitioners out there.
That's what we're often exploring in the mental health or yoga training as well. So, for yoga teachers who have no other qualifications or training or skills, the mental health aware knowledge that they're learning will help them to support their students who are experiencing mental health challenges in their regular classes, not running like yoga for depression classes or doing anything therapeutically. But for those who are also yoga therapists or who are, trained mental health professionals, then there's some, other avenues to bring it in more therapeutically. I really hear what you're saying, and I think that what can happen is that students look to their teachers and think, oh, they're yoga teachers, they must know everything, or they must, be able to help me with the problems I'm having with my child, or know which essential oils to use for this, or, like can ask all sorts of questions that really were totally unqualified to answer. But we feel pressured, like we need to know what it is. And so I think while scope of practice is kind of like we were talking about before, like the safety of our students, It is also for ourself as well, because I think if we can let go of the idea that we have to know everything and be kind of the all-knowing teacher at the front of the room, it is such a relief. And I think that knowing what we know and what we don't know isn't always easy, but we can get there. I think it can help our students to trust us if we can learn to communicate that. I know myself, if I ask somebody a question, like a therapist or a teacher or somebody in the community question, and they say, "Wow, that was a good question. I'm not sure, but I reckon we could find the answer here," rather than just making it up, I trust them so much more than if they just tried to put something together that they didn't fully know or understand. So I think it's important for the safety of our students and clients, but it's also such a relief for teachers and therapists that we don't have to know everything.
Let's take just a little pause and talk about something that's really exciting. There's a new book coming out in spring 2026 called Applications of Therapeutic Yoga in Integrative Health. It's authored by Amy Wheeler, myself, and Marlisa Sullivan. We've been working really hard on this book for about 18 months, and now it's scheduled for release in spring 2026. This text will bring together philosophical foundations of yoga, emerging research in neuroscience, and evidence-informed methods for applying these teachings in clinical and community settings. The book is designed for healthcare providers, yoga teachers, yoga therapists, educators, and really anyone seeking to clearly understand the why of why yoga works and the how, the mechanism underneath why yoga works. Your purchase of this book will help to advance the field of yoga therapy, and it will support the continued development of resources like this podcast, the Yoga Therapy Hour. And we hope it will serve both you and your clients alike. So please keep an eye out for Applications of Therapeutic Yoga in Integrative Health by Amy Wheeler and Marlisa Sullivan coming out through Routledge Press in 2026. All right, let's get back to the episode. And I think that's why I love that you've written a guide for yoga teachers, and you're potentially going to write a guide for clinicians. Because, if someone comes to you, you're a licensed clinical psychologist, and let's say I've not been trained in any of that type of schooling, and I'm learning these things from you. While you are qualified to do them and teach them, I may not be because I don't have that additional training. And that's where I think it gets really sticky is we kind of adopt the degrees and qualifications of our teacher and just think, well, I can do that too. And maybe not.
Forgetting the 10 years that they spent at university to get there.
Yeah, or vice versa. I mean, I also want to say, and I feel really strongly about this, and I know it makes people mad, but it's very upsetting to me when we have a licensed healthcare practitioner, a physiotherapist, or a psychologist, or an occupational therapist, or a PA who takes a 200-hour training and then calls themselves a yoga therapist. Like, I don't think that is correct either.
Agreed.
And I know the field is new, so the who gets to call themselves that is still kind of a little bit jello-like. I do believe that clinical degrees plus 200 hours doesn't equal something, you're a licensed
No, agreed.
healthcare practitioner who teaches some yoga.
Agreed. Yeah. And as we were talking about before we came on, that's exactly what I am. I'm a clinical psychologist, meaning that I've done a doctorate degree in clinical psychology and a yoga teacher. And I've been doing both of those for more than a couple of decades. And I've taken some parts of yoga teacher training courses. I've done a few modules with Ganesh Mohan many years ago on the psychological parts of it. But I have never done a full yoga therapy training, not because I don't want to, but because I have limited time and money, and I'm very intentional about where I put those, especially because I have two kids and want to be as present for them as I can. And so, while I'm not a yoga therapist, and I'm always very careful to let people know that, what I do do is integrate these worlds of clinical psychology and yoga psychology together. Yeah, but that's a really good point.
Some people ask me, well, why not? Why can't we just do what we're talking about? And my answer is that the lens that we're looking at the human through is a completely different lens. It's like a long distance glasses versus computer glasses. It's a different lens.
Yeah, and it's a different framework right from the start, right? Like the interview process at the very beginning is very different, and the way that you engage in a session is very different, and the way that you might set homework is very different as well.
Yeah, the co-negotiation or co-assessment process is very different.
Yeah, and I don't think one's better or worse than the other. They're just different frameworks to be looking through. And also, my understanding of yoga therapy, and I'm saying this not as a yoga therapist, so correct me if I'm wrong, is that one, it has this different framework, but two, it's a full body and mind training, whereas psychology is on the mind. More and more, we're including the body, but only through this kind of somatic lens, not through how do we work with knee pain or back pain or something like that. So it's very different in that capacity as well.
Yeah, I love that point. So you talk about yoga psychology, and I want to hear what that means to you because I have a friend named Joy Stone that for a long time was teaching yoga psychology through the lens of Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. That basically, Patanjali's sutras are kind of like a guide for daily living. How would you describe yoga psychology?
Yeah, I think I would describe it in a similar way. I think,
Really?
we can look at the Yoga Sutras and the Yamas and the Niyamas as a guide to help us to navigate life. What we really focus on in mental health aware yoga is looking the gunas and the koshas. That's not all Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, it's partly, but not all. But I think these frameworks can be particularly helpful as individuals, as yoga teachers and therapists, as a way to look through the world. So the koshas, for example, we talk about the body, the breath, feelings and emotions, wisdom, body and joy and Anamaya kosha. And I think often psychology just looks at emotions and thoughts. When you go and see a psychologist or a mental health professional, that's mostly what we're looking at. When we go to kind of a regular, like a standard studio yoga class, that's mostly about the body. And if we're lucky, a little bit about the breath. And what I think is important is that we understand that we're more than just the body and the breath, and we're more than just our thoughts and feelings and emotions, and that we take a full integrated approach. And that means that we can change our internal experience or nurture ourselves in different ways, depending on where we want to come at it from, whether it's through the body or the breath or emotions or thoughts, wherever it is. And truly, I feel like a well-rounded approach to mental health will take all of this into consideration. Now, this doesn't mean that a yoga class, like a general yoga class, has to address all of the koshas. It doesn't. But I think that yoga is a great adjunct with psychotherapy or with yoga therapy. And if one therapist or teacher can address all of that, great. But often what happens is that they'll be seeing a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a counselor and then going to a yoga class. And by doing both of those, kind of like a top-up and a bottom-down approach, you're addressing all the koshas. And I think that's the piece that's often missed, both in Western psychology and when we go to general yoga classes. I'm sure in yoga therapy that you address all the koshas there, but in these different fields, I think they're missed often.
I'm not sure what's happening in Australia, but our American Psychological Association and Social Workers Association is basically kind of starting to say we don't want to accept continuing education with body-based somatic therapies because you weren't trained in that. And it's upsetting a lot of people because
It is.
we are all starting to learn about the top-down and the bottom-up approach and how powerful the bottom-up approach can be. So I just wanted to throw that out there too, that there is a little pushback now from the psychological communities to say, look, you can't be doing all this body stuff. You're not trained in that.
Wow. So they
Wow, I
don't say,
know.
let's get you trained in that because it's evidence-based approach to trauma and mental health care. They say you can't do it.
In the Veterans Administration, that's kind of been the new rule within the last year is no, don't do that unless you have another license to do that, right? Such as yoga therapy. And like I said, with the CEs, I work for the Polyvagal Institute with Stephen Porges, and our work can't be used as CEs for psychotherapists anymore.
Wow.
I know. That's just been within the last few months.
Oh no.
I know, it's really
That's
a disturbing
surprising.
trend.
Well, I don't think that's happening here in Australia, but I'm not as tuned into the psychology world as I used to be. Like I said, I think my frame's changing, but we have a very different way of getting, we call them CPD points here in Australia. And with psychology, anyway, the course doesn't have to be registered with anyone. The registering body just trusts that we're going to make good decisions for ourselves. So we just need a certificate.
Wow.
And as long as we can justify that it meets our learning plan for the year and meets our professional development needs, I'll take it.
I love that.
So it,
So
I
much.
often get questions from therapists in the States saying, "Is your course registered with XYZ?" And I always feel a little bit baffled by it because we don't do that here. I haven't quite got my head around how it works in the US.
Imagine that. We trust you, and if it fits within your learning plan, I love that.
Having said that, in Australia, we tend to kind of follow what happens in the US or the UK. So we'll see. I hope that doesn't happen. For your sake, that those changes back off, and also for our sake here in Australia as well. Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
Because the body and the mind are ultimately one. We've only separated them out to study them and look at them. So,
And even like the research more and more is showing how important it is. So if you're asking your clinicians to engage in evidence-based practice, that's not evidence-based. And if you really feel like people aren't trained in it, then like, encourage people to get trained in it, right?
Go get those CEs.
Yeah, they're making it worse, not better. Okay, now we're going off on it.
All right.
Now I'm talking about government policy in a country I don't even live in, about something I don't even
Hey,
know about.
Americans,
We
we
turn
do
this back off.
that all the time. We think we know everything.
I'll
So let's
just
move to
quietly step
an
back from that.
okay, we quietly back off. Let's go into another lovely part of your book that I think is so important, and that is basically teaching yoga teachers how to create a safe container. So tell us a little bit about that part of the book, the safe container.
Yeah, I think generally yoga teachers do this so beautifully, but I think it is something that is so important for mental health. Let's say it doesn't matter what we teach. It definitely matters what we teach, but even more than that, the way that we hold the space and the way that we teach it, I think is can be incredibly helpful and healing, or conversely, it can be harmful as well. So in the book, we talk about the idea of a safe container. And what we want to do is make the space and our presence as safe as possible. Now, we're never going to make anything 100% safe. We can't make it completely safe for everyone all the time. We don't know people's lived experiences and the state of their nervous system and their histories. But we can, do some things to make it more likely that they will feel safe. Because if we don't feel safe in a space, one, we're probably not going to come back. Two, our nervous system will get even more dysregulated rather than, become more sattvic, which is what we're aiming for more often than not in yoga. And three, we're not going to be able to kind of get the benefits of the practices, right? If we're feeling unsafe, we feel guarded, we're not going to kind of soften into and let the teachings or the practices filter in. So we're not going to get the benefits anyway. So doing what we can to create a safe container is, I think, like foundational, and in and of itself can be incredibly healing, because for some people, they've never had this experience of going into a space where they felt welcomed, where they felt relative safety, where they felt included and a sense of belonging. And that in itself, that relational piece and the safety of the nervous system is, it sounds small, but it is huge for all of us, but particularly for people who haven't had a lot of that in their lives. And unfortunately, it's actually not uncommon. So, in practice, what that might look like, there are so many kind of small different ways that we can do this. One of the things you mentioned earlier was around predictability. And I think that's really important that we be predictable as yoga teachers, or as yoga therapists, or as mental health professionals. Predictable doesn't have to mean boring, and it doesn't have to mean rigid, but it's when people come to see us, they come into our room or they come into the yoga studio, that they know what to expect. They're not getting surprised or startled, and they don't have to be on alert because something might happen at any time. So some simple ways to do this might be starting and ending your classes on time, starting and ending your classes, right, in a similar way. each time. So they come and they know we do this at the start and we do this at the end. It might be, like I mentioned before, letting students know how long you're inviting them to hold an asana or to do a pranayama practice for, so they can anticipate how long it's going to go for. Of course, they can finish whenever they want. They don't have to do it for the whole time, but giving that predictability of that time framework. What else can it be? It's the way that you set up the space. I've taught in some yoga studios where some teachers will have the mats facing this way and some teachers will have the mats facing that way. And that can be quite confusing and disorientating for people. Making sure that students know where the exits are, that no mats are placed in front of the exits so people can't leave. People know where the bathrooms are, that the exit doors are unlocked from the inside. I know in some countries, especially in countries where they have guns, that being able to lock the doors can help people to feel safe, and having that predictability can be helpful. But if it's locked from the inside and you can't get out, that can feel very unsafe as well. Yeah, so that's a few examples of different ways to make things predictable.
I love all of those. And, one of the things we say at the Polyvagal Institute is kind of tell people what's going to happen. And it seems kind of strange that you would do it every single time, but we're going to start with a little centering to land here today. Then we'll do a breath practice or two, and then we'll get up and do some postures for maybe 30, 35 minutes. If you need to stop before that, you're welcome to. Then we'll come into a lying down Shavasana and we'll be there for 5 to 7 minutes, and then we'll close up our time together. Like, to think about kind of saying that almost every time, it seems like a lot, but it's important. It gives
Yeah,
people that
agreed.
sense of, I know what's going to happen. There's not going to be any big surprises. And it's not boring because the whole sequence within the structure can be different every time. You might do back bends, you might do forward bends or twists or a focus on a
Exactly.
breath ratio or
Agreed.
a mantra or a visualization practice that kind of weaves through. There's still so much variety and creativity that can happen within that.
Yeah. And for the students who have heard that explanation before, they don't really care. They're just there to practice and they trust it. They can just tune that out and that's fine as well. But for the rest of the students, it can be profoundly helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, is there anything else you'd like us to know about your book or your work? Anything that is really alive for you that kind of when you think of it, you get that little excitement inside, like, oh, I love this part.
I don't even know how to pin that down to one thing because I'm so excited about all the work that we're doing here. One thing that's really coming up for me lately is the power of the relationship. And so I think many people come to this work wanting to share certain practices with certain things. And this is one of the misconceptions that why yoga is so helpful for mental health is that we do this posture for depression and this posture for anxiety. And the reality is that's not how it works. For sure, there can be different practices that can be helpful. And the way that we sequence things can also be really helpful in helping us to regulate our nervous system. Really, one of the most powerful things is the relational piece, the relationship that we have with our therapist or with our teacher, and this feeling of connection and warmth and safety. And really, what that requires to do that well as a teacher or a therapist is one, we don't have to be perfect. We only have to be good enough. So we don't have to wait till we're perfect ourselves. And what can be incredibly helpful is to be doing our own work, to do what we need to do to regulate our nervous system, to, see a therapist if we need to have a therapist, to be doing our own practices and going to classes and having sangha and being embedded in the teachings and tending to ourselves means that we can show up as a good enough yoga teacher with hopefully relatively well-resourced nervous system. Because what we're often doing as therapists and teachers is like we're renting our nervous system. I can't remember who said that to me, but I thought it was such an interesting way of looking at it. When we're sitting with somebody one-on-one or we're teaching a yoga class, there's this resonance between us. And if we're sattvic, if we're well-resourced and our nervous system is regulated, the class or the student in front of us is going to feel that. If we're not, and we don't have to be all the time, and I think that's really important to name, but if we're chronically not, then the class is going to feel that as well. And either that will disturb them, or more likely than not, they just don't get the extra benefit of a well-regulated or resource teacher. And that, I think, is a really important part of this work.
And so when you say you're renting, meaning you're leasing it out to your student, your resourced, balanced nervous system is being kind of leased out for that hour.
I guess, yeah, we're not giving it away and we don't want it to deplete it, right? Like we want to hold that for ourselves as well. But we know that there is this resonance, this co-regulation between nervous systems. And if we're regulated, that can have an incredible impact on our students' nervous system, no matter what we're teaching or saying.
Yeah, I love that.
And I wonder, I interviewed Jai Utal on my podcast the other day, and he spoke about it's called Unseeking a Guru. So we talked about the guru lineage, and he shared about his experience of going to India and sitting with his guru. And he said that his guru actually didn't teach anything. He just kind of sat there and smiled, and they ate food together and did some chanting. And as we're talking now, that just came to mind. And I can't help but wonder if part of that, probably not all of it, but part of that was the co-regulation of a regulated nervous system.
That's what Shakti thought is when you go and sit at the feet of an enlightened being or someone who claims to be that energetic transmission of Shaktipat. I think that is part of like nervous systems linking up for better or for worse, you know?
Yeah, for better or for worse. And now that we have this information and we understand co-regulation and how it works, let's use it for better, right?
Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely.
And isn't it also a beautiful invitation to look after ourself? So often we can get caught in this kind of, I need to be in service martyrdom, right? And we put everybody else first, our students, our clients, our kids, the whole world, because we think that that's what it means to be a good person. That's what it means to be of service. But actually it doesn't. I don't think. This is what I'm learning anyway,
No,
right? Like this
I
is a
agree.
hard one realization, to be clear.
We're learning it organically from the inside out, moment to moment. Yeah, I've often thought about that, we've all been through hard times where we literally are dysregulated chronically. We show up and we do our best, but we're probably not renting out a very great nervous system in those moments. It happens.
I mean, I keep kind of touching on this, but let me say it more explicitly. We don't have to wait until we're 100% regulated. I don't even know what that means. I don't even think that's possible. We don't have to wait till we've totally got our shit. I don't know if I'm allowed to swear on this podcast
You can.
together.
Go for it.
Because I don't know if that ever happens,
Yeah.
right? And we don't have to be perfect. And actually, maybe even if we did get to that point, it would probably be so inaccessible for our students that it wouldn't be helpful anyway. I remember when I was studying psychology, this idea of the good enough mother. Well, now we will probably say the good enough parent. And I think that's true. We can be a good enough teacher or have a good enough nervous system. We do not have to be perfect. In fact, it might be inaccessible and prohibitive, even if we were, even though I don't think it's even possible. But can we show up as best that we can and be aware of these things and really value our own needs and our own self-care and really tend to ourselves and deeply nourish ourselves? Like, as I'm saying this, it sounds like a, you can't pour from an empty cup kind of thing that everybody says, but actually doing it and living from this way, I think, is a totally different thing. Are you intellectualizing it and posting about it on Facebook, or are you actually living from this space? I mean, I've learned myself how different those two things are and how difficult it actually can be.
I want to have a little confession here because many women have told me this, that the asana that we've done for 10, 20, 30, 40 years isn't working for us anymore. And in order to get that deep inner sense of nourishment and well-being, we've had to kind of completely change what that looks like for ourselves because we have wonky SI joints now and our knees hurt and our back hurts and our neck hurts. And like we can't just do asana now. With my own practice, even though I am very much in the Krishnamacharya tradition, I've also given myself like an hour and a half in the morning to explore what is going to make me feel good. And a lot of times that's slow weight training or a vibration plate, maybe
Beautiful.
a little Pilates, maybe a few asanas, like, and it's very freeing, but there's also this weird guilt, like, ooh, I'm stepped out.
I'm betraying yoga.
I
Yeah.
but
You
it
know,
was
I think,
nourishing me, so I
yeah,
had to.
I love that you say that. And I think what we really need to get clear on is what is our intention? Why are we practicing? Are we practicing to perfect the primary series in Ashtanga Yoga? Are we practicing to be loyal followers of Krishnamacharya lineage and the practices that they give? Or are we practicing to feel nourished? Are we practicing to, you know, seek enlightenment? You know, why are we practicing? And get very clear on that intention, that sankalpa, and then practice in a way that supports that. And I don't think it matters if it's true. I mean, this is me personally, and it sounds like you as well. It doesn't matter if it's traditional yoga asanas and pranayama. And I know myself, I have my morning practice, which is a very still practice because that's what works for me. But then I also go to a local studio where we do quite dynamic vinyasa classes. Yesterday, I went swimming with my daughter. My daughter's just joined the gym. And so I've just, for the first time in my life, started to go to the gym and like do all these machine things, which I've never done before. But it's actually quite fun, and I know that I want to be strong in my body. As I age, as I'm almost into my 50s, I want to make sure that I'm strong. Yeah, it's interesting. Like in my 20s, I did a lot of dynamic yoga. I did a lot of Ashtanga, and I love that dynamic yoga. I think it's just what my body and my mind needed. Kind of in my 30s, when I was having babies and I was exhausted, I did so much kind of very gentle, very intuitive, very nourishing. And I thought I will never go back to that dynamic way of practicing that for like young folk with strong bodies and busy minds. But then as I've come into my 40s, I'm like, no, I want to be strong. And I did Pilates for a while, but then I was like, no, I can get strong with yoga as well. So then I started going to these vinyasa classes, and they've got the music and all the sun salutations and all the stuff. I have a background in dance as well. So there's something in me that does the sun salutations and the music and the strength. It works, which surprised me because I didn't think that it would. But again, it's coming back to this intention. Like, why am I practicing? Like, what do I want to get out of this? And doing something in alignment with that, right? Rather than trying to do something that doesn't fit with us and fit with our bodies and our lives and our hormonal changes and our seasons.
Beautifully said.
That
Well, Lauren, it's been so lovely to spend this hour with you. Thank you for going from everything from scope of practice to policy to
my
personal practice to creating a safe container. We really hit a lot of different things that you talk about in your book. So, can we just take a moment to look at one of your websites and just talk about anything that you're maybe have coming up or something that you do regularly? Well, I just wanted to say this is www.yogapsychologyinstitute.com.
That's it. Thank you. That's really generous of you. So there's two programs, the main programs that we're focusing on this year. One is the mental health aware yoga training. So this is a 6 month that's under trainings. The other one at the top, we have an online training that's starting on the 16th of February, 2026. By the time you share this, that might have passed, but we'll be offering it. We offer it every year. And then we also often have hybrid trainings as well. These are often in my town in Mullumbimby, but we've also had them in Denmark and New Zealand and around the place as well. So post-COVID, now it's post-COVID, we might get back into doing more of those hybrid trainings. I've only done a couple since COVID. And then the other one is the yoga psychology mentorship there. And so this is a 5 month program. And I started this because I do a lot of one-on-one supervision with psychologists and other mental health professionals who are also yoga teachers. They may or may not be yoga therapists, but they're yoga teachers. And they're wondering how they can bring these worlds together because it's not clear cut. There's a psychology over here and there's yoga over here. And they're like, I know in my own body that this is good, but I don't know how to bring this into my work, and I don't know how to bring it into my work and not get in trouble. And so that's why we've created this mentorship. We did it for the first time last year. It'll be running again in, I think, May or June. And both of these trainings just light me up. Like I'm in my happy place at this intersection of people who are both yoga teachers and interested in mental health. I'm also going to be offering a free series of interviews. As we record this, I don't have the dates or even really the name of what it's going to be yet, but it's going to be something like the Yoga Informed Therapist interviews. It'll be up on the website when it's ready. And what I've been doing the last few months is interviewing some incredible mental health professionals who are also yoga teachers or yoga therapists about how they bring it into their work. So I've been interviewing Dr. Ariel Schwartz and Richard Miller, Annika Sipps, Marianne Kaplan. Oh, so many. I can't remember off the top of my head. I've been having these incredible conversations and I'm going to share it for free in a few months' time. I'm just off to India in a month and then to Indonesia. And when I get back, then we're going to be sharing them.
That sounds amazing. I can't wait
Oh, I've
to
had
hear that. So
the
people can
best time.
back to www.yogapsychologyinstitute.com to find those free
It'll
offerings.
definitely be on the website.
Somewhere around May and June.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank
Thank
you
you, Amy. What a
so
joy to have a chat. And thank you for inviting me to share about what I'm offering.
much. Thank you. Have a wonderful, wonderful day.
Have a beautiful evening.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Lauren Tober, for such an interesting conversation. I would like to inspire each and every one of you to take a deep look at some of the things that we talked about. Specifically, what is it that you are centering? Are you centering the yoga with a little bit of psychology and evidence-based medicine on the side? Or are you centering the Western allopathic healthcare lens with a little bit of yoga on the side? And it really matters for you to know which one of those you're doing. It's just a form of self-reflection. And so I think we will leave you with that. Marlisa Sullivan and I have an upcoming book that will be due out late spring into the summer of 2026. We're not sure exactly when it will come out, but we are writing this book with yoga as the center and licensed healthcare kind of as the side dish. So it took us a while to get clear about that, and it's a really special book that I hope you will consider checking out when it is published. So, thank you, everyone. It was lovely to be with you today, and we'll see you next week. Thank you for being a listener of the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast. We have done over 200 episodes, and we have had over 200,000 downloads. And we hope that in some small way, we have supported you mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. If you'd like to support the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast in 2026, there's several meaningful ways you can do so. First, you can become a member of our Patreon community and donate as little as $5 a month to keep the podcast going. Your contribution helps us to sustain the depth and quality of conversations on the podcast. A second option is that you become an Optimal State mobile app member for both Android and iPhone. Again, this is about $5 a month, and we're going to start providing a lot of amazing content on our mobile app in 2026. We'll definitely want you to be part of that community. We also have a book coming out called Applications of Therapeutic Yoga in Integrative Health. This book will be published by Routledge Publisher in spring 2026. It's written by Amy Wheeler and Marlisa Sullivan. We hope you'll consider purchasing this book when it comes out in the spring of 2026. Again, the name is Applications of Therapeutic Yoga in Integrative Health by Wheeler and Sullivan. For those of you who are seeking advanced training in therapeutic yoga or in yoga therapy, please consider checking out the programs at Notre Dame of Maryland School of Integrative Health. We have a MS in yoga therapy, and we also have a post-master's degree therapeutic yoga for licensed healthcare providers that's starting in the fall of 2026. In addition, we have a comprehensive Ayurveda certificate program also geared towards licensed healthcare providers. Each one of these programs is a pathway designed to support healthcare professionals and yoga teachers and yoga therapists who are ready to integrate these teachings into clinical, education, and community settings. All right, thanks for listening and thanks for supporting the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast. We wish you a wonderful week. We hope that somehow, in a small way, we've contributed to your well-being so that you can go out and share that well-being with others. That's what life is all about, bringing in the goodness through you and then shining it out to the world. We need you more than ever. So let's all get out there, do good, be good, and have a great week.